Hi everyone, and welcome to Tyndall Talks. This is the Tyndall Center's official podcast. I'm Renee from the Tyndall Center at the University of East Anglia. Our episode today is about citizen engagement in climate governance. More specifically, we will talk about climate assemblies, where representatives of the public come together and discuss issues. Citizen assemblies in the climate sphere are becoming more popular, especially in the UK and Europe. But how do they work, and why are they important in the context of the climate crisis? And can we all join a citizen assembly? Our guest today is Stephen Elstub of the Tyndall Center at Newcastle University. Stephen joined the Department of Politics at Newcastle University in 2015 and is currently the Director of Research. His main research interests are in the theory and practice of democracy, democratic innovation, public opinion, political communication, civil society, and citizen participation, all viewed through the lens of deliberative democracy. He has been involved in research on Climate Assembly UK, Scotland's Climate Assembly, and the Global Assembly on the Climate and Ecological Crisis. Hi, Stephen, and welcome to the Tyndall Talks.
Hi, Remy. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. I'm really interested in your work because I've actually just recently finished my PhD, and it was in political communication and deliberative democracy. So this, to me, your whole work is a very, very interesting, and it's something that I think is very important in the climate space, especially when we talk about climate policies and how to implement them. But just to start off everything, how do citizens' assemblies work?
Thanks for your interest in my work and congratulations on the PhD. On to citizens' assemblies, how do they work? Well, there are a number of defining features, and each plays an important role. So the first is, how do we get the participants of the citizens' assembly? And this is done through a process called sortition, which is a combination of random selection followed by a process of stratified selection. This is, stratification can occur around whatever you think are the key dimensions, but usually things like age, gender, race and ethnicity, income, or it can also include attitudes on the issue to be considered. So for example, some of the climate assemblies have sampled on attitudes towards climate change as well, to make sure that there's people who are very concerned there, people who don't necessarily even believe it's a thing that's happening, and then the variance between those in between. And the idea of that process then is, if it's done well, everyone has an equal chance of being selected, which is important, but also you get a diverse group of people representative of the broader population on those key demographics. And this goes a long tradition of research on public opinion, which shows that if you get, you don't need to ask everybody in order to understand what the public thinks. If you get a good, reliable sample, that can be an indication of what the public as a whole think. So a good analogy would be a chef making a soup. And in order to decide whether it needs more seasoning, you don't eat the whole pot and go, yes, actually, that did need more salt. You just try a teaspoonful, and from that sample, you think that that is a reliable sample to judge whether you need more salt and pepper, etc. So that's firstly how you get people. Another key feature is, and once you have recruited your participants, is how they're supported. They're usually paid to attend, their travel is paid for, accommodation is paid for, childcare, if that's relevant, is covered. If it's an online assembly, obviously like travel and accommodation may not be necessary, but IT support, making people sure people have the skills and the equipment to go online and to participate online. It's all about lowering the barriers of participation to get people who would not usually participate in politics involved in the debate. And then next, once that they're there, they're given balanced information on the topic. This is trying to capture a range of different perspectives on the issue at hand. This is often delivered by expert or advocate witnesses, but it means that they're able to make, the assembly members are able to make an informed decision on the remit that they've been given. their discussions. They then discuss this information that they've been given and aim to come up with recommendations. But those discussions are facilitated to try and promote what we call the norms of deliberation. So that means making sure the discussion is inclusive, making sure it's not just a few loud peak voices dominating, but that everybody gets an opportunity to have their say, that the discussions are respectful towards each other's opinions, even though they have different views on the matter, and that they justify what they want as well. They don't just say, I think we should do X. It's why do you want that? And those reasons, and should ideally have a bearing on what's decided. And that is the final stage. And they do decide on a set of recommendations. This can often be in this form of some underlying principles that they all share, but also actual specific policy suggestions that government could implement.
Good. Thank you for that overview. Just a little bit to expand on what you said. So first on the diversity, I mean, as a person of color living in the UK, for me, diversity is really important, especially in, you know, the climate movement. Sometimes I've seen that the climate movement can be just too white. So how do you like ensure that there is a good representation of ethnicity, but not just ethnicity, maybe also gender, because all gender is also, you know, impacting differently, depending on, you know, what gender you are. Like women are more impacted by climate change, for example. And also, what about persons with disabilities? Is disability also something that is considered when it comes to diversity?
So I'll take the last point first, and then I'll come back to the others. So disability could be included as a criteria, but it's not necessarily. But you could have that as one of your selection criteria, and then make sure that you had people from the disabled community present. In terms of then how you ensure, you know, like you say, ethnic minorities there, that women are there, etc. So there's various different ways of doing the selection. Sometimes it's random digit dialing. Sometimes it's people going around door knocking on randomly selected postcodes, or quite common those, you select some postcodes randomly and then send a letter inviting people. Some instructions, maybe then a link to a survey so that they can give some basic demographic information. And then from that pool of people who've indicated that they're willing to participate, you've got some demographic data on them, and then you can select accordingly, so you can make sure you get the ethnic groups that you want there. But you make a very good point, and this is something that's starting to happen in the Citizens Assembly model, is traditionally the participants have been in the number there, reflected of the percentages within the border population. But you made a very good point that actually, you know, some minorities are going to be more affected by climate change, and actually perhaps they need more of a voice. So there is an argument actually for over sampling on certain characteristics, and I think that's something that perhaps should happen, and some places have experimented with that to a degree. The North of Tyne Combined Authority Climate Assembly, I was on the oversight panel for that, and we oversampled on ethnic minorities, but we could have gone further and perhaps should have done, and that's something I'd like to see happen.
Right. And so we've discussed a little bit, obviously, why citizen assemblies are important. But are there any other points on, you know, why citizen assemblies in general, and maybe in the context of the climate crisis? Why is it crucial?
Yeah, so I think, firstly, why are they important in general? I think it's because we do have some significant problems with how democracy is working at the moment. And in particular, the public have a real lack and declining trust in established democratic institutions. They don't trust politicians to make decisions in the public interest. And we see this as well in that there's decline in voter turnout, decline in party membership. And these are issues happening in the UK, but they're happening in many established democracies as well. Obviously, the dynamics are vary, but as a general trend, we see much of this. And yet people still want to have a say in policy making. So the traditional structures to enable people to do that in democracies aren't working very well. So we need to look for new avenues for political participation. And as a result, we've seen a rise of what we might call democratic innovations, which are ways to try and get the public participating and deliberating on public policy. And citizen assemblies are just one type of these democratic innovations. But there was problems with just general political participation that citizens assemblies are designed to try and to overcome. So it's often they're too dominated by what we might call the usual suspects, the most engaged, the most interested. And these people are not representative of the population as a whole. And there's socioeconomic dynamics to that as well. So, you know, it's white, male, middle class people like myself who are more likely to participate and therefore get their say to the exclusion of other voices. Also, because they're the most engaged and interested, they often come with fixed and predetermined opinions. So they're not willing to listen or engage to the other, listen to the other side. And quite often they're not given the opportunity to do so. We tend to discuss political issues with like-minded people, so we're not exposed to alternative perspectives and other views. Also, people can often have very little, if you're not one of the most interested and most engaged, you may have very little knowledge on an issue or may have given it very little thought. So, for example, with standard opinion polls, you might get stopped on the street or you might get phoned up or sent a survey or something asking your opinion on something that you don't know anything about. You haven't really considered it, but you've been asked an opinion, so you provide one. But it's not really considered thought through informed opinion. So citizens' assemblies are an attempt to address all of these problems. But moving specifically to the climate crisis and why citizens' assemblies or climate assemblies, which is what we'd call citizens' assemblies on climate change, might be relevant. And again, it's representative democracy is failing to sufficiently address the climate emergency. We keep getting reports highlighting this. But I would argue that this isn't just a coincidence or an accident. These are structural limitations of representative democracy to deal with longer term issues such as climate change. Politicians are just looking to the next election, which is only ever a few years away. So they're not thinking longer term. They were trying to respond to the media coverage on that day, to the public opinion right here, right now. They can be susceptible to lobbying, and as a result, they often engage in climate delay discourses. But ultimately, the longer term issues do not get addressed satisfactorily. Whereas climate assemblies, as I say, citizen assemblies on climate change, because of the many features I mentioned earlier, such as how the participants are selected through random and stratified selection as opposed to election, they are less susceptible to these failings of representative democracy. But with the climate change issue as well, in order to have climate action that's going to address the issue, it's really important that the public are on board, that they are engaged, that they do have a say in what a just transition would look like, what type of action that they want to engage in, what sort of policies that they want. And so climate assemblies are one avenue that enables that to happen.
Yeah. And we were talking about earlier about decision makers and how political participation has, you know, decreased over time. And I was wondering, with the citizen assemblies, you know, once you gather everyone there, they have, of course, different opinions, sometimes maybe opposing opinions. Do these things get resolved in the citizen assemblies at all? I mean, what happens?
It's a very good question. So one of the fantastic things that I think when I've observed these in action is that firstly, you not only when you walk into the room or, you know, you go online, if it's an online assembly, do you see such a great diversity of people in one space, which is fantastic to see and rare in any other occasion. But, you know, on the climate assemblies that I've been involved in, you get people with very strong, differing opinions on climate change issue. Like I say, for people who are really concerned about this to people who are not concerned at all, or, you know, don't even necessarily accept that it's a problem, discussing these issues together. And where else do you see that happening? And they're discussing it, not just, like, you know, they're not shouting at each other, they're discussing it constructively, they're respecting each other's opinions and trying to learn from each other, obviously trying to persuade each other as well. So in that sense, they're a real success. Now, we also see that research shows that people learn through this as well. So they learn from each other, but they also learn from the experts and the witnesses and the information that they're provided. And so they know more about climate change and climate action at the end of the process than they did at the same. They feel that as well. But also we ask some sort of specific questions which suggest that they do have learned. They do change their opinions as well. So they do tend to become more concerned about climate change. They do become more supportive of climate action. Now, that's not everybody. So you do get some who come to the process not accepting that climate change is a thing or not particularly concerned about it, and they remain like that all the way through. But the general trend is across the participants become more concerned and more in favor of climate action than at the beginning of the process. You know, they propose policy recommendations that would do more to address climate change than the current status quo. More research needs to be done on those recommendations to see whether, you know, they would achieve the aims of reaching net zero, for example, et cetera. But certainly that they go further than what we currently have. And actually, a lot of the participants, we did some follow-on research on Climate Assembly UK, for example, and there we found that, you know, not only at the end of the process had people changed their views, but actually we went to speak to them a few years later, and many of them had changed their behavior in terms of political activity, but also environmental activity, things that they were doing at home. Some have started sort of like, you know, new businesses that were trying to be more eco-friendly, or some had become local and politicians, local councillors and things like that. So it's not, so some of these changes permeate further beyond for years after as well. So in that sense, it they do work. But yeah, I don't want to make out like everybody gets convinced that around that climate change is an emergency and agrees on what we should be doing about it. But plenty of people do change.
Yeah, and I guess that is the role of deliberation, isn't it? Like the theory of deliberative democracy says that the more deliberation that happens, the more we can actually change our behaviors and, you know, our thoughts, which doesn't happen often when you're just on social media scrolling and in a filter bubble. But just one more, I guess, on this thread of thought. When the citizens assembly happen and, you know, you get all of these opinions, suggestions and feedback from citizens, how do politicians actually take these? Do they actually, you know, consider what is being said there, or do they just go on with their plans anyway? You know, I mean, it's difficult to understand how, you know, governments and politicians actually take on citizen opinions when they already have maybe a plan set, you know, of what they want to do.
Yeah, that's another great point. So I've just highlighted the sort of success parts of climate assemblies, which is what happens within the assembly, that, you know, you get people with differing views discussing reasonably and respectfully these issues, and becoming more informed and coming up with some recommendations. But what happens after that is the challenge, and they have struggled to make a big impact on climate policy and governance, I think it's fair to say. I mean, there's been a lot of cases now within the UK and across Europe. So there will be variants here as well. But in general, I think, you know, governments have had a tendency to cherry pick the recommendations from the assemblies that they were already planning on doing, or we've seen that they retrofit existing policy to make it to say, oh, well, look, they respond to the assembly and say, look, you've asked us to do this while we're actually already doing it, or they often get ignored completely. So there is a problem there, and there are things that I think can be done going forward to enhance the impact of climate assemblies. So firstly, the scope of the assemblies has often been too broad. You know, ultimately, what should we do about climate change, which is a big issue, a big complex issue, and whether then they're given sufficient time to be able to consider an issue like that that scale. So it also leads to, because the issue is so big, then they come up with a very, very long list of recommendations. Mm-hmm. And this can make it difficult then to hold the government to account, to respond accordingly to the climate assembly. So I think they would benefit from a more specific focus, which they could have a say in deciding themselves. But that would lead to a smaller number of recommendations that are more specific, more focused, and therefore easier to hold government to account. And I think maybe take up could be increased then. But also, public awareness of climate assemblies has been low. And this is important because ultimately, you know, even though they're trying to get diverse samples, it's still only small numbers of people. So the key question is then whether they can lead public opinion, you know, whether the public can say, well, this is what people like me have decided. I'll take that as a guide. And we have found some evidence for that. For example, in Scotland's Climate Assembly, we did a survey of the population. We found that even some people who are not that concerned about climate change would still like to have seen the Scotland's Climate Assembly's recommendations implemented. So there is potential there for them to guide public opinion. But at the moment, it's not really happening because public awareness of them is very low. But if there was more public awareness, then I think the government would feel under more pressure to respond and implement. So we need more media coverage. And we have seen examples like in France, where the climate assembly there was well known, very highly visible within France. So it is possible to achieve it, and we need to learn some lessons there. But ultimately, I think we need to embed citizens' assemblies and climate assemblies in our political systems to make them more permanent, to make them less ad hoc and less like one-off processes. So we need to have rules on when we have them, rules on how they are run, and importantly, rules on what would happen to the recommendations. So it's not possible just for the government just to ignore it. There has to be some sort of formal response or formal way of how they're going to be dealt with. And that would ultimately then make them harder to be ignored. We've seen in Brussels now has set up a permanent climate assembly. That's quite a recent thing. So it's perhaps too early to judge, but it'll be interesting to see what happens there. And I think that's the direction of travel at the moment, is that we're going to start to see more embedding of the citizen assembly model in political systems rather than this ad hoc processes that we've seen previously. And I think will enhance their impact over time.
Yeah. So I think we've discussed a little bit the effectiveness of citizens' mm-hmm. assemblies, and you've mentioned a few examples of citizens' assemblies, but I was wondering, is there any maybe one specific citizen assembly where the recommendations have actually been taken and implemented by the government?
So I'm not aware of one where the government have just gone, yes, we're just going to do all of that. And sometimes, so you see assemblies at different levels of government. So we've had from local regional, national, and we've even had a global assembly. So I'm not aware of a case where a public authority has just gone, yeah, we're just going to do all of that. And like I say, it's because some of them are happening at local level, there's things that the assembly might be recommended that are not necessarily within the competence of that particular public authority, so they're not actually able to. So I think really it is that just variability that some have implemented more than others. And yeah, one of the most effective ways to see implementation has been when they've been followed by a referendum, for example. So then it's you're kind of taking the MPs out of the politicians out of the cycle, and it's, you know, the public that get to decide whether they should be recommended, although maybe politicians that decide whether it goes to a referendum. So there's no one specific example where everything's been implemented, and it is just there's varying degrees of implementation from nothing at all to a reasonable amount and everything in between.
Yeah. And I guess you've already also mentioned how we can encourage more governments to hold citizen assemblies. But I guess my follow-up question would be, because you also mentioned how, you know, a lot of people actually have low political participation and sometimes don't want to be involved. And so how do we also encourage citizens to be part of a citizen assembly and to be involved, you know, more politically involved?
Yeah, so a few things saying. So firstly, you know, a citizen assembly is just one model, one way of getting the public involved. And it's not always appropriate. It's not always the best thing to do. So I don't want to move to a model where it's just citizens assemblies and nothing else. Mm-hmm. So we need to encourage other opportunities for political participation as well, and try and combine these other opportunities. So I mentioned at the beginning that a citizen assembly is one type of what we call democratic innovations, new ways to engage the public in deliberation around policy issues. But there's others: collaborative governance, participatory budgeting, referendums, citizens initiatives. So we want to be encouraging those as well and learning how to combine citizens assemblies with them. There's also lots of citizens assemblies already happening or happened in the UK and Europe in general, and specifically climate assembly, citizen assemblies on a topic related to climate change and climate action. So I think firstly, it's not necessarily that we want more of them. It's about learning to do them better, and particularly in terms of the policy follow-up to maximise their impact. So more embedded permanent assemblies rather than the ad hoc one-off events, I think, is what we need. Yeah. In terms of then how can the public get involved, how can the listeners get involved? I mean, this is one of the features of a citizen assemblies. You do have to be invited following, you know, random selection. Mm-hmm. So the way to be involved is, if you do get that invitation, I would recommend accepting the invitation, as I think it would be a rewarding experience. But if you're not invited and your local government is having a climate assembly, then you can follow its activities. There's often opportunities for input online. You know, in the Tyndall Centre, we obviously have main eminent climate scientists. They may be invited to be an expert witness in the process. If they are, I'd again encourage them to do so. It's an opportunity to you know, it's a vital part of the citizen assembly process. But follow it, and if you like the recommendations, then campaign for them to be implemented. Try and make sure that the politicians do follow up and don't just ignore the process.
Thank you. That's actually a very good suggestions and advice for our listeners who, you know, usually ask us, well, what can we do? But aside from citizen assembly, because you also mentioned earlier that, you know, citizen assemblies are only like one way to get involved in, you know, policy making, as a specifically climate policy making. So what other things, you know, if they don't get invited, or other things that they can actively participate in, can you suggest as well?
So I mean there's obviously this process. We've seen a lot of people engaging in climate action protests at the moment. But again, that's a difficult way to make a difference as well, to get government to listen to that. So democratic innovation, I think that protest is essential, and it's really important in terms of raising the profile of the issue and trying to highlight the urgency of the need for climate action. The other sort of democratic innovations I mentioned tend to be more top-down rather than bottom-up processes, but as a result, they do tend to have clearer links with decision-making. So beyond citizens' assemblies, lots of local governments have participatory budgeting processes where certain budgets are set aside and people can make recommendations for how that should be spent and then vote on it. And there's been some councils that have had specific budgets for environmental issues, for example. So there's opportunities there, and anyone can participate in those. It's not like the closed system that we have within the citizens' assemblies. But yeah, I would just look out for as many opportunities as people can afford the time to engage in. But I think with this, just to finish on the citizens' assemblies model, I think it is crucial that if people are aware of it, then that will raise the profile of them. And the higher the profile that they have, the more likely they are to make a difference. It will become harder for politicians to ignore them if there's good public awareness.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks for joining us today, Stephen. And I hope our listeners have gained a better understanding of what citizens' assemblies are. And who knows, maybe our listeners can join one of these assemblies one day and help shape climate policies. So thank you for listening to us today, and see you in the next episode of The Tyndall Talks.